Welcome to Monday Morning Murder in the News with Alyssa Carroll.
Good morning, heathens, and happy Murder in the News Monday. Sorry about missing last Monday. I just didn't have time to record, you know, life and that kind of stuff. Okay, let's get into it. All right, so our very first article comes from People.com. I know there was some question as to me relying on People.com, but these are articles that are sent to me by my beloved listeners, and this is for entertainment purposes only. So anyway, title reads, Police Officer Charged with Murder of Missing TV Host and His Boyfriend in Australia. Police allege Beaumont Lamar Condon killed his ex-boyfriend and his ex's new partner before dumping their bodies. Both of the people in this picture, quite handsome. Okay. An Australian police officer has been charged with murdering his ex-boyfriend and his new partner who went missing earlier this week. New South Wales police officer Beaumont, 28, was taken into custody Friday morning, according to CNN, and charged with murdering Jesse Baird, 26, and Luke Davies, 29. It's alleged that Beaumont was previously in a romantic relationship with Baird, a former television host for Network 10 in Australia. After the couple's relationship fell apart, Baird had most recently been involved with Davies, who was a flight attendant. Local news outlets described Lamar Coden as a, quote, celebrity chasing cop, noting he previously ran a blog about celebrities and posted photos of himself on social media, posing for pictures with the likes of Taylor Swift and Lady Gaga. If I have to hear that name, Taylor Swift, one more time. He allegedly turned himself in on Friday, according to NSW Police Detective Superintendent Daniel Doherty, who arrested the media after his arrest. No, who addressed the media after his arrest. Doherty said neighbors called police after hearing a loud argument at Baird's home on Monday, where investigators later found bloodied belongings inside the home. The detective superintendent said investigators had discovered, quote, a large amount of blood inside the house, according to NBC News. Baird and Davies' bodies have not yet been recovered. Oh. During their search of Baird's home on Monday, Doherty also said that investigators allegedly found a bullet and a cartridge case that had been fired. Quote, this has now been ballistically matched to a New South Wales police firearm, Doherty told reporters, according to the outlet. And that firearm belongs to the 28-year-old man who was charged today. So authorities allege that Beaumont then rented a van that he used to dispose of Baird and Davies' bodies. Police said they tracked down the van as of Friday afternoon, but did not reveal what was found inside of it. Investigators said they're still searching for the bodies, which they expect will shed more light on exactly how the two men had died. Doherty also said investigators do not have a specific motive for the killing yet, but categorized it as a, quote, domestic-style incident. I mean, it's jealousy, right? That's one of the main causes for murder. Quote, it's really important we get the movements in relation to that van, as hopefully we can find the bodies, and this is important for the family, Doherty said, according to CNN. They're obviously devastated by the news. That is absolutely messed up. Okay, so this one happened kind of the end of February, but I still find it important to share because I know people that live in Idaho. In Idaho, like, we've got Lori Vallow and Brian Koberger, like, all kinds of shit going on in Ohio, or Idaho, right? So this comes from abcnews.go.com, and the title reads, Death Chamber Glitch Halts Execution of Serial Killer Thomas Creech. The U.S. Supreme Court had rejected Creech's request for a stay. Serial killer Thomas Eugene Creech, Idaho's longest-serving death row inmate, was spared from death on Wednesday after the medical team assigned to administer a lethal injection failed to establish an IV line, preventing the execution from proceeding, officials said. The 73-year-old Creech was to be executed at Idaho Maximum Security Institution near Boise, just hours after the U.S. Supreme Court denied his last-minute request to stay his execution. Quote, Mr. Creech will be returned to his cell and witnesses will be escorted out of the facility, the Idaho Department of Corrections said in a statement. As a result, the death warrant will expire. The state will consider next steps. End quote. The surprise twist came after Associate Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan issued a decision Wednesday morning denying Creech's request for a stay of execution, clearing the way for prison authorities to carry out the ultimate punishment. Attorneys for Creech had filed a, I don't know how to pronounce that, petition that the High Court halt the execution to give the panel time to review the decision by the Idaho Supreme Court denying Creech's appeals. Quote, the application for a stay of execution of sentence of death presented to Justice Kagan and by her referred to the court is denied, the ruling said. The addition for a right of certiorari is denied, end quote. Make fun of me, it's okay. Days before the execution, Idaho Governor Brad Little said he had zero intention of halting the execution at Idaho Maximum Security Institution near Boise. Quote, Thomas Creech is a convicted serial killer responsible for acts of extreme violence, Little said in a statement issued on January 29th. His lawful and just sentence must be carried out as ordered by the court. Justice has been delayed long enough. End quote. In the petition to the Supreme Court, Creech's attorneys argued that his due process rights were violated by the Idaho Supreme Court. Quote, Mr. Creech has identified a substantial need for guidance from the court on an issue of great national importance, and he has brought a strong vehicle for it to do so. Creech's attorney wrote in the petition asking for clarity on the question of when a state's post-conviction regime affords little meaningful review to legitimate federal constitutional claims that it violates due process. The petition added, there are strong reasons to suspect that at least some states have gone too far in limiting post-conviction review, thus calling for the court's intervention. So the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco also denied Creech's latest appeal in a ruling issued Saturday, prompting attorneys for the condemned man to take their argument to the Supreme Court. Prior to the death chamber glitch, Idaho Department of Corrections issued a statement Wednesday morning saying it is prepared to move forward with Creech's execution. Quote, last night, Mr. Creech visited with his wife throughout the evening. Additionally, his religious advisor spent an hour with him this morning. Mr. Creech had fried chicken, mashed potatoes with gravy, corn rolls, and ice cream for his last meal. Mr. Creech has remained cooperative in the days leading up to the execution, the Corrections Department statement read. Creech, according to prosecutors, has been convicted of 5 murders in 3 states, including 3 committed in Idaho. In a 1993 opinion issued by the U.S. Supreme Court denying an appeal filed by Creech, late Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that, quote, Creech admitted to killing or participating in the killing of at least 26 people. The bodies of 11 of his victims who were shot, stabbed, beaten, or strangled to death have been recovered in 7 states, she said. The last murder that Creech pleaded guilty to occurred in 1981 at an Idaho maximum security prison when he killed 23-year-old David Dale Jensen, a disabled fellow inmate, by beating him to death with a sock filled with batteries, according to prosecutors. At the time of Jensen's slaying, Creech was serving two life sentences for a double murder he committed in Idaho and had been convicted of murders in California and Oregon. Creech argued in his recent appeal that his due process rights were violated by the Idaho Commission of Pardons and Parole and the Ada County, Idaho Prosecuting Attorney's Office. At a hearing in October, Ada County Deputy Prosecutor Jill Longhurst told the commission that Creech is a sociopath who has utter disregard for human life. Quote, Mr. Creech is a serial killer, and in 1981 said he would kill again, and he did, Longhurst told the commission. Thomas Creech is the most prolific serial killer in Idaho. So Creech's execution came despite pleas to spare him from the most unlikely advocates, prison staffers who have cared for him behind bars. A former prison nurse, a former prosecutor, prison guards, and even the judge who sentenced Creech to death all filed declarations backing his request for clemency, which was denied in a 3-3 vote on January 29th by the Idaho Commission of Pardons and Parole. Judge Robert Newhouse of the 4th Judicial District Court in Boise, who sentenced Creech to death in 1983, said his declaration to the commission that Creech should serve the rest of his life in prison and that executing him would, quote, just be an act of vengeance, end quote. And that's the article. So what I have to say about that is I understand that the death penalty is kind of a touchy subject, maybe not as much these days because we have so many other things to be bitching about to each other and at each other on social media and on the internet. But the death penalty has been a kind of hotly debated topic, right? So I'm sort of pro death penalty depending on circumstances. And this man had a hand in murdering 26 people, right? Now, I don't know his story. He's kind of a new one to me. So, you know, let me know if you want me to cover him or put him on the list. But he admitted to murdering and said he would murder again, bragged about it, if you will, and then did murder again. And so I don't understand why anyone would say, oh, it's just an act of vengeance. He deserves it. Why are the taxpayers still feeding and housing and, you know, giving free medical care to this man who had a hand in taking out 26 people? If he had taken out one of your people and then was just lackadaisical about the whole thing, oh yeah, I've murdered and I'll murder again, and then he did? I don't know why anyone would advocate for him. Seems a little freaking ridiculous to me. But anyway, moving on. So our next article comes from KOIN.com. KOIN 6 watching out for you, and the title reads Oregon Medical Examiner. 54-year-old cold case breakthrough is bittersweet. The Oregon Medical Examiner's office said more cold cases could be reexamined with additional funding for genetic genealogy. So this is coming out of Portland, Oregon. A break in a decades-long Oregon cold case has finally helped solve the identity of a young woman whose remains were found 54 years ago today. Investigators worked for decades to solve the mystery of the skeleton found in a shallow grave on Sauvy Island, I believe pronounced, on February 23, 1970. Forensic anthropologist Nikki Vance started looking into the case back in 2004 when the state medical examiner's office took on many long-shelved cases. As DNA technology advanced, they started analyzing the remains. So, quote, that DNA profile was loaded into this database. It was searching for many years since 2011 and just didn't hit to any missing persons profile, any family reference profiles, Vance said. They were able to eventually analyze the DNA enough to see what she might have looked like, but still, there were not enough leads to get an answer to who she was. When the Oregon State Police Medical Examiner's Office received a national grant to start looking into these technologies, they were able to look at forensic genealogy data after seeing it used to catch the Golden State Killer. Quote, We knew that this was a technology that could be utilized, but not necessarily to find a suspect, but to identify these unidentified individuals that we have had in our facility, some for decades, Vance said. Whoever wrote this article, guys, what is happening to proper punctuation? Years later, a match came in 2023 after a family member submitted their DNA to GED Match, and detectives and scientists began to work with the potential family. Finally, this past year, they identified the girl as their teenage sister, Sandra Young, a Grant High School student who went missing in the late 60s. Quote, "It was a good feeling. It's bittersweet to find this first and last name of this young girl who had her whole life ahead of her," Vance said. Just like Young's case for years, many remain unidentified, about 1% of medical examiner cases each year. Quote, "They're either recognizable or they're skeletonized. We've performed certain analyses on them, but we can't necessarily move the cases forward," Vance said. She adds that, with continued advances in technology, they will continue to reanalyze cases and ultimately hope to get them back to their loved ones. Quote, "I think our community needs to know that we'll never give up on these cases," Vance said. "There are still many cases here in the state yet to be solved," and Vance says a lot of that will also come down to funding. Genetic genealogy casework and testing can cost around $6,000 to $10,000 for each case. Yikes. But I'm glad that she was identified. At least the family has something, right? And I cannot find the article. I don't know if I accidentally deleted it. I don't see it in here, but I took a screenshot and I just wanted you guys to know in case many of you probably won't know who this is. Some of you will, but this guy named Ian Watkins, he was the lead singer of the band Lost Prophets out of, he was originally from Wales, but anyway, out of the UK, and he has been in prison for a while because he was a horrific child sex offender. When I say horrific, I mean horrific. If you want me to cover him, let me know. Ian Watkins, the Lost Prophets lead singer. I'll cover it. It's fine. But anyway, the point of this is that recently he got stabbed a bunch in prison, and more power to the people that stabbed him, honestly, because he's just foul. Moving on. And our next article comes from Yahoo.com, Yahoo News, and the title reads, "Search for missing Florida 13-year-old ongoing as her mother's boyfriend is arrested." A search was ongoing Thursday morning for a missing Florida 13-year-old girl who was last seen Monday as her mother's boyfriend, whom police call a prime suspect, has been arrested. Madeline Soto was last seen around 8:30 a.m. Monday when her mother's boyfriend dropped her off a few blocks away from Hunters Creek Middle School in Orlando, Orange County Sheriff John Mina said. At 4:30 p.m., when Madeline's mother went to pick her up at school, she learned her daughter never made it to school that day and had left her phone at home. By the way, nobody leaves their phone at home, especially not youths. A search for the child was launched that night. Stephen Stearns, 37, the boyfriend of Madeline's mother and the last person to have seen her, was arrested Wednesday evening on charges of sexual battery and possession of child sexual abuse material, authorities said. Oh, grand. Though he was not arrested in direct connection to Madeline's disappearance, the Orange County Sheriff's Office said, quote, "Stearns is considered the prime suspect at this time." During the investigation into Madeline's whereabouts, Orange County Sheriff's detectives discovered, quote, "disturbing images and videos that were, quote, criminal and sexual in nature" in a forensic examination of Stearns' phone. They also discovered attempts to delete evidence. It was determined that those crimes were committed at the family's home in Kissimmee, and local police were notified and are leading the sexual battery case. The department shared video showing Stearns silently being placed into a patrol car. He was interviewed Wednesday night by Kissimmee Police and OCSO detectives. He invoked his right to an attorney and was placed under arrest and transported to jail, the sheriff's office said. Quote, Stephen Stearns had an opportunity tonight to come clean with detectives and help lead them to information about Maddie's disappearance, Mina said. Her loved ones deserve answers, and OSCO and the Kissimmee Police will not stop until we find Maddie. So, the search for Madeline started Monday night. So, a bloodhound smelled an item of Madeline's and did an extensive search, but it didn't lead to any results. Detectives also accessed Madeline's phone and found information on the phone, quote, that indicated that she told people when she turned 13, which was on February 22nd, she actually wanted to go live in the woods, Mina said. The search so far has seen more than 100 deputies, detectives, intelligence analysts, and bloodhounds search for her, including in a wooded area near the school. Mina said Wednesday afternoon that Madeline's family's home in Kissimmee was being held by the Orange County Sheriff's Office until police could secure search warrants, which were expected to be executed that evening. Madeline described as blonde with blue eyes and 5'1" tall, was last seen wearing a green sweatshirt, black shorts, and white Crocs. Anyone with information on her whereabouts is urged to call 911 or the Orange County Sheriff's Office. And then it says this article was originally published on NBCNews.com. We do not want me to not give out the sources. Our next article comes from KTLA.com, LA's very own KTLA 5. And the title is, Authorities Seek Help Identifying Remains Found in Orange County. And then they've got like an artist rendition of her. I don't know how to describe it. She kind of looks like Eva Menendez. Is that her name? The lady that was on Desperate Housewives. She kind of looks like her. Authorities are working to identify the remains of a woman who was found in Orange County as a new forensic image was released. In January 2014, authorities discovered the remains in a rural area at Casper's Wilderness Park. Investigators with the OC Sheriff's Department believe the remains had been exposed to outdoor elements for at least 6 months. The victim is described as a petite woman who was at least 30 years old. She had shoulder-length, dark brown, wavy hair with light-colored highlights. She had a, quote, very distinct gold-colored dental bridge on her lower left jaw and possibly had a broken nose at some point in her life, officials said. She was found with a dark blue jacket featuring a volleyball or water polo logo on the left chest and Coach Williams embroidered on the right chest. In 2015, a CT scan of the woman's skull and mandible was completed, allowing a forensic artist to complete a photo rendering of the woman's possible appearance. In 2020, investigators attempted to develop a genetic profile from the woman's DNA samples, but they were not successful. In 2023, investigators partnered with the Ramapo College of New Jersey's Investigative Genetic Genealogy Center to develop a genetic profile using a DNA sample from the woman's tooth. That sample was then sent to Intermountain Forensics, which is a private lab in Salt Lake City. This latest attempt was finally successful, and based on the new genetic information, investigators believe the woman is primarily of Latin American descent. An updated photo rendering was completed by a forensic artist based on the successful genetic profile. The circumstances surrounding the woman's death remain unclear, but investigators believe her case was a homicide. And then it says anyone who recognizes the woman, but you're just listening to me. But anyway, so an Orange County, LA woman's remains. You can Google that and see a picture of her. So anyway, I certainly hope that they can get her identified. So our next article comes from FoxNews.com. title reads, Fisherman Attacked with a Harpoon, after he and a friend argued about which man caught the bigger fish. Because we all know that if you can't decide who caught the bigger fish, murder or attempted murder is obviously what you're supposed to do, right? Doctors had to perform surgery after a 45-year-old fisherman suffered a bizarre harpoon strike to the head. Medics were shocked to find that a fisherman had been struck with a harpoon and not by accident. There's no way I can pronounce this name. S-U-J-I-T. Sujit? I'm going to say Sujit. I apologize if that's offensive. Was out with friends fishing and drinking beers in the Nakhon Ratsima province of Thailand when the recent incident occurred. So this is coming from Thailand. The 45-year-old told Viral Press that he and another friend got into an argument about which man had caught the bigger fish. Quote, I was fishing with my friend, and we joked about the fish we had caught. I said that I had caught bigger fish than him, but he was offended, he said, out of anger. This man's friend decided to aim a fishing harpoon at the back of his head, which lodged inside in the skin. No, this harpoon went through. There's an x-ray on here. I apologize. Quote, when the harpoon first hit me, I felt the pain in my head, but I had a cigarette and felt better, he recalled to Viral Press. This is interesting. This man's friends quickly put him into the back of a pickup truck and took him to the Maharat Nakhon Ratsima Hospital. I'm sorry. There, volunteers had to cut off most of the foot-long harpoon before doctors could perform surgery. With just a few centimeters left inside his head from where the harpoon was positioned, the doctors at the hospital were able to remove the harpoon. One doctor told Viral Press that that man was lucky to be alive. Quote, the angle of the harpoon went through the flesh and into the ear. Okay, well, the X-ray is a side shot, so it looks like it went right through the kind of bottom, like it might sever the spinal cord, but I digress. So it says, he added, if it had struck further to the right, it would have damaged his brain and he would have died. He reportedly will need to have more exams to assess if there's any further brain damage. Man, that is just crazy. So, our next article comes from cbc.ca, coming out of Ottawa. Six dead, including four children, in Ottawa mass killing. So, police have identified the victims of a mass killing in the Ottawa suburb of Barrhaven as a Sri Lankan newcomer family, including a mother, four children, and a 40-year-old acquaintance who was living in the home. Six people, including a mother, her four young children, not all the kids, and a family acquaintance were killed inside a townhouse in the South Ottawa suburb of Barrhaven late Wednesday night. During a media briefing Thursday afternoon, Ottawa Police Chief Eric Stubbs said there were initially two calls to 911 around 10:52 p.m. local time Wednesday. He said first responders arrived within minutes to the home on Berrigan Drive near Palmetto Drive, a residential area close to two schools. Police have identified five of the victims as a family of newcomers to Canada from Sri Lanka. So there was a two-month-old daughter, a three-year-old daughter, a four-year-old daughter, a seven-year-old son, and 35-year-old mother. I'm not even going to disrespect their memory trying to pronounce these names. So police said that the mother's husband was injured and is currently in the hospital in stable condition. He's since been identified as Danushka. Another man, 40-year-old Gamini, whatever, was also killed. Febrio, 19, is charged with six counts of first-degree murder and one count of attempted murder. Police said he is a Sri Lankan national who is believed to be in Canada as a student. On Thursday evening, The Algonquin College president, Claude Brulé, released a statement confirming DeZoisa was a student at the college and that it, quote, appears his last semester of attendance was winter of 2023. He made his first court appearance late Thursday afternoon. He spoke little, stated his name and birth date before sitting down. He was ordered not to contact five people, one of whom was this husband. DeZoisa's next court appearance is scheduled for March 14th. Now, police said this kid is also an acquaintance of the family and was living in the home at the time of the killings. He was arrested at the scene about 15 kilometers south of Ottawa's downtown core. Chief Stubbs said the family's youngest daughter was born in Canada and suggested the family members had arrived at different times. He said Ottawa police had never dealt with either the suspect or the family and had never been called to that address before Wednesday night. During Thursday's update, Stubbs called the killings, quote, a senseless act of violence perpetrated on purely innocent people. He offered his condolences to the victims' loved ones for this unimaginable loss. Quote, this homicide will undoubtedly weigh on the hearts of everyone for a very long time. Ottawa police also say there's no ongoing risk to public safety. The deepest condolences to the family. Why? Why did he do that? Stubbs told reporters on Thursday afternoon that A-Edged, who is writing this stuff, honestly? A-Edged? N-Edged? Thursday afternoon that an edged, knife-like, edged weapon was used in the homicides. I can't even with this. In an earlier interview on CBC News Network, he had initially called the incident a mass shooting, but it was not. While police did not speculate on a motive for the killings, Stubbs earlier told CBC investigators not to believe it to be a case of intimate partner violence. And scrolling through the rest of the article, I see nothing that talks about any kind of motive or anything like that. So that's super interesting. It's really bad. And kill and murder children. He just snapped and murdered everybody. That's whatever. Our next article comes from people.com. Yes, I know. And the title reads, a girl refused to drink a smoothie allegedly spiked by Oregon dad, how her texts led to his arrest. Michael Maiden, 57, pleaded not guilty to charges accusing him of drugging three 12-year-old girls staying at his house for a sleepover with his daughter. A 12-year-old girl's decision to not drink an allegedly spiked smoothie at a friend's sleepover last summer proved vital when she managed to get a ride home in the middle of the night and alert her parents that her friends might be drugged, a probable cause affidavit obtained by People says. Investigators allege that 57-year-old Michael Maiden had laced a batch of smoothies with benzodiazepines and insisted his young daughter and her three friends drink them before going to bed. Maiden turned himself into a Lake Oswego Police Department last week and pleaded not guilty to 9 felony and misdemeanor charges, including causing another person to ingest a controlled substance, the department said in a news release. I certainly hope the parents of those other girls had, like, took their girls to be tested to see if they had drugs left in their system. You know what I'm saying? His bond was set at $50,000, and county jail records reviewed by People show he's no longer in custody. Two of Maiden's daughter's friends drank the smoothies during the August 25th sleepover and soon allegedly fell into a, quote, thick, deep sleep, one of the girls told police the next day, according to the affidavit. Police met the three girls who stayed over at Maiden's house and their parents at the hospital the following morning. Okay, here we go. The girls' parents became concerned when two of the girls required help walking and could not recall what happened to them the night before, with one girl telling police she blacked out after drinking two of the smoothies, the affidavit alleges. The mango smoothies allegedly had small white chunks in them, and white powder on top, the girls told police, alleging that Maiden gave each of them a unique colored straw to use, the affidavit claims. The girl who managed to alert her parents later in the night had decided not to finish her drink after taking a sip and complaining about the taste. She alleged to investigators that Maiden made her a new smoothie, which she also didn't like and didn't finish. Maiden allegedly later became upset with the girl because of course he fucking did. According to the affidavit, and accused the girl and his daughter of switching straws between their first and second cup. The girls stayed up for about an hour longer talking and watching TV. Two of the girls visiting the Maiden's house shared a pull-out couch in the basement, while Maiden's daughter and the other friend shared a bed in an adjacent bedroom. The girls who didn't drink the smoothie pretended to be asleep when Maiden came down a short while after and allegedly began doing tests to make sure the girl sleeping next to her was asleep. She alleged to police Maiden was placing his finger under his friend's nose and waving his hand in front of her face. Finally, he allegedly removed the girl's arm from around her friend and began to separate them on the pull-out couch they were sharing. When Maiden went back upstairs for a moment, the girl began frantically calling and texting her mom before reaching out to several friends. As a mom, this is very upsetting. Quote, "Mom, please pick me up and say I had a family emergency." The girl frantically texted her mother at 1:43 a.m., per the affidavit. "I don't feel safe. I might not respond, but please come get me," crying emoji. "Please, please pick up, please, please," all caps. Her mother did not respond, but the girl was able to reach a friend who sent their mom to Maiden's house. The girl told Maiden she had a family emergency and he did not try to stop her from leaving. Once home, she woke up her parents and told them what happened. Her parents had reached out to the other girls' two parents, who then went to Maiden's house around 3 a.m. to pick up their daughters. That is my girl. This girl, if you're listening, and I'm sure you won't be, that's my girl. That's what I'm talking about. So you know that he knew his ass was grass, right? Kids getting picked up at 3 a.m. Later that morning, they decided to take the girls to nearby Randall Children's Hospital, where all three of the 12-year-old girls tested positive for benzodiazepine, according to the affidavit. Police obtained a search warrant later that night and confiscated a Vitamix blender, a mortar and pestle, cups, straws, tramadol, and 5 bottles of temazepam from Maiden's home, per the affidavit. That reminds me of Michael Turney from the last podcast I put out. Less than 2 months after the incident last summer, Maiden got divorced from his wife of 16 years. He's now living in Vancouver, Washington. Maiden's attorney, Mark Kogan, told the press, basically, his client is presumed innocent and we hope that people will reserve judgment until all of the facts and circumstances are known, end quote. No, because he literally was making these smoothies, color coding the straws to see who's drinking what. That is so disturbing. That is so disturbing. And I bet that girl who, and that's her dad or her stepdad or whatever, I bet she felt absolutely horrible. That's terrible. But I'm glad the parents, I mean, like, good on you, girls. Good on you. And then for our final article, I let this one go a little longer to try to make it up to you guys because I didn't get one out last Monday and I'm sorry. This one comes from Fox13News.com and the title reads, this is coming out of Tampa Bay. Title reads, "Outraged ex-girlfriend breaks into Florida home, dumps pickled pork inside before slinging soda bottle." This was sent to me by a listener who emails them to me and this sounds fun. I mean, I hope nobody got hurt. So coming out of Florida, right? Bottles of Sprite and pickled pork landed a Florida woman in jail after deputies say she threw one of the items at her ex-boyfriend and doused his couch with the other. According to the Lee County Sheriff's Office, I can't pronounce that. We'll just call her Akiva, used a hidden spare key to get inside her ex-boyfriend's home. Once she gained access, deputies say she threw and broke items around the house. According to the Lee County Sheriff's Office, she even took a bottle of pickled pork and dumped it all over the victim's couch. There is a picture here. It is a green, looks like leather pleather sectional. There is definitely a large jar on its side with a bunch of what looks like little red turds on the couch. Pickled pork, I guess. When a deputy arrived at the Lehigh Acres home for reports of a burglary, he said he saw the victim outside with Reddick chasing after him. Reddick is that chick's name. Let me go back up here and see. Yeah, Reddick. We'll call her Reddick. I don't know how to pronounce her first name. When a deputy arrived, yeah, she was chasing him. So body cam videos show Reddick, who deputies say was still heated from an argument inside the home, throwing a 2-liter bottle of Sprite at the victim. The deputy proceeded to ask Reddick to go over by a tree away from the victim so he could talk with the victim. The suspect says she will listen to the deputy but points a finger at her ex-boyfriend and says, "You, I'm not going to listen to you." Reddick was arrested for battery, burglary, and criminal mischief. Interesting. Not funny, but also kind of funny, right, guys? So, guys, we made it through another week and another weekend. Last week and this weekend have been pretty trying for me, so sorry if the mood is not where it needs to be, but, you know, I had a lot of stuff to do this weekend. I tried to at least get out of my house and get some, you know, vitamin D and get some movement in my bones, and I feel like that's helped me a little bit, but the people that waited on me this weekend, I appreciate you. My weekend workers, we love you guys so much. Thank you for putting up with us, and I apologize for all the assholes you had to deal with. Outside of that, just have a great week, guys. You know, tell your loved ones you love them, all of that cheesy, warm, fuzzy, huggy shit. Do it. You won't be sorry later. All right, love you guys. Bye.